Hey everyone, you're listening to episode 14 of the Art Scene Podcast. Today's guest is Whitney Lin, an artist based here in the Bay Area, who recently last year was named the 2016 National Artist in Residence at the Neon Museum in Las Vegas, and will soon be the Artist in Residence at the DeYoung Museum this year. She also teaches at Stanford University and the San Francisco Art Institute. Currently, she has a show up at Bassett Rayner Gallery titled After the Fall, which runs till February 25th, so be sure to check it out before then. So for today's podcast, Whitney and I had a great talk, not only about her background and her practice, but also about what is coming up for her over at the DeYoung and the War Memorial Building here in San Francisco. We also talked a bit about the relationship between art and politics, which is a subject that's recently been on my mind lately with everything that's going on right now. But before we even get into our conversation, I want to remind my listeners to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and be sure to leave a comment as well. It helps spread the word about the show, and the more comments we get, the more visibility the show gets. All right, well, here's our conversation. So it was great seeing you the other day at the reception for your show over at Bassett Rayner. So is that the first show you've ever done at Bassett Rayner, or is that have you done one before?
No, yeah, this was the first time, and I knew Marielle a little bit. She was in one of my classes at the San Francisco Art Institute, yeah. And then it was my first time meeting everybody else over there.
Yeah, and that was the other thing. So I didn't know. I learned two things. One, I didn't know that you went to SFAI, mm-hmm. where I also went to school, and two, I didn't know that you teach there as well. But how long have you been teaching at SFAI?
Wow, I think I started there around 2010.
Oh, yeah.
But don't quote me on that. Somewhere around there, yeah.
Well, when did you graduate?
2007.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't that long after you were teaching there.
No, I started, I was teaching anywhere and everywhere that would take me. And yeah. So someone would say, can you teach design? And I'd say, yeah, of course. I love design. And they go, can you teach painting? Yeah, I love painting. And so it was kind of have gun, will travel. All over the place, and then it was really nice to come back home and be at the Art Institute.
Where are you originally from before you came to San Francisco?
Well, it's always a funny question because I always say I'm not from anywhere. My dad was in the military, and okay. So we moved around all the time, mm-hmm. and I've lived in San Francisco longer than anywhere else, mm-hmm. so I'm sort of from here at this point, but I came out here initially in 98,
okay.
and I came out to go to the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And I dropped out pretty soon after arriving, and then ended up going to school out in Virginia. And I went to Virginia Commonwealth University, and they have a really amazing sculpture program. And then found my way back out here in 2005.
Why Virginia?
That's where my parents had moved.
Oh, okay.
And so it was kind of a stroke of luck that they had such a good program there, and it was in-state tuition. And I didn't even know that I wanted to do sculpture. I actually started to go back into the music program there. And then the art school had better parties. And yeah. No, but I think, I just fell into it. And, I feel like I really lucked out.
So I come from a military family, too. It's actually that's how I got to San Diego. My dad was in the Marine Corps, so like for 13 years. So we like moved to Florida, to San Diego, back and forth. I was born in Guam on a naval base. So, the reason why I asked that was because I saw that in your place of birth on your website was an Air Force base.
Right.
And so I was like, this is kind of like my situation.
Yeah.
But how many places have you, like, did you move around to before? I mean, it sounds like Virginia seems the last place your family settled before you went off.
Yeah, and my dad was not in the military by the time that they moved to Virginia, but Arizona, Florida, Michigan, New Jersey, Texas, Virginia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's funny that the thing about Williams Air Force Base, because I was recently out in Phoenix. And Williams Air Force Base is somewhat close to Phoenix, like maybe an hour out. And I'm like, I really want to see this place.
Yeah.
So went out and drove, you know, to the middle of nowhere. And then, you know, it's decommissioned now.
Right.
And it's actually Arizona State has dorms there.
So they bought the land.
but then I'm going around and I'm looking, and No, of course I don't remember anything about it because we only lived there for like 6 months. Yeah. And so it was this thing of trying to capture some memory of place that didn't exist. And then I felt really stupid. And it was also the middle of summer, so it was like 110 degrees on this old Air Force base. But yeah, I was trying to figure out where I was from.
So, I mean, it sounds like music was originally like kind of your first love. Is that always, where did that influence come from?
You know, I started playing the piano when I was like 5 or 6. I just really wanted to play the piano. I begged my mom for lessons. And it was one of those things where I was pretty good at it. And then when you're in a small town, like if you're pretty good, you're like really good, like you're the best. Yeah. And I think it was a shock when I actually got to the conservatory and realized, oh no, if you want to be good, you're going to have to practice, you know, 12 hours a day. And then you're still not going to be as good as some of these others. And I think it wasn't something that I had considered if I really wanted to invest in particularly classical music or if it was just, I felt like that was what I already knew how to do. And it's funny because it feels like a past life at this point because I don't play music or think about music at all. To be totally candid, I think I realized I wasn't as good as I thought I was.
Yeah.
Which probably happens a lot to people going to art school too. Oh, like they're, you know, they draw like better than anyone else in the whole high school. And then they get to art school and it's like, yeah, but what you're drawing about? And then it's like, oh, and so I think partly it was, an issue of recognizing that I wasn't as talented as I had believed to be, but then also thinking about what is my career actually going to be, because the orchestra jobs are really hard to get. And so it would probably, I would be teaching, you know, lessons and then getting gigs here and there. I started doing a lot of weddings. That might have been the kiss of death. I started playing like tons of wedding gigs, and you can only play at so many people's weddings before you like realize like I need to get a new job. Sorry to all the wedding people listening.
Yeah. So then what made you go into visual arts?
It was something that I was always interested in art, and that I didn't have the same kind of confidence because I thought that art was all about talent and a very kind of specific sort of talent with rendering skills and drawing. And I just didn't think that was possible. And then I think going to VCU and then meeting people that were in the art program there and getting turned on to art that was about ideas.
Yeah.
And then seeing that anything is possible, that I decided that it was okay to venture into it. But I don't think I would have given myself that license if I hadn't just met some people that were there. And also it was a state school. I think it cost like $2,000 a semester at the time.
Yeah.
So you didn't have, you know, it's a different kind of investment when you're at a private school.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you go to Virginia Commonwealth University. While you're there, what was kind of like the first medium that you started working with then? Because I look at some of your work, and it's varied, like for different mediums that you use, but which was the first?
Well, I just had some flashes of some really embarrassing things. you know, I think maybe partly attached to just not knowing that much about art, I initially thought that I wanted to go into the crafts program.
Okay.
And so I was dabbling around with, like, different crafts classes.
Yeah.
And then I pretty quickly realized that that's not actually what I wanted to do. But,
right.
So yeah, there's like some really like bad glass things and metal, and then I was trying to make conceptual metal sculptures, but they're really pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
But the sculpture program was great because it's kind of like the new genres program at SFAI, mm-hmm. where it's called sculpture plus extended media.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, video. I did mostly video when I was there. Video and then performances for the camera.
Right.
And I did very little actual sculpture until I came back out here.
Right. And so then what made you come back out to San Francisco?
I love San Francisco.
Yeah.
I think it was just that I missed San Francisco.
Yeah.
Was the number one thing. And then also, you know, SFAI has such an amazing history.
Yeah.
And it was, I just felt like it was the place I wanted to be.
Yeah. And so when you made it out back to San Francisco, how did your work kind of transform over there, or how did it progress compared to what you were doing in undergrad?
Well, I had a little bit of time off from when I was in undergrad, and when I was in undergrad, I was making at the very end of my time there, I was making really didactic political work, and it was Bush was in office, and I was making videos with Bush blinking and State of the Union address pieces. And I just found this one, this old image today that was dressing up like business people and stealing candy from 7-Elevens to try to, you know, stand on a soapbox and make a comment about things. But so I think when I came out to grad school, it was the first time that I really confronted thinking about how can I make political art that maybe is a little more nuanced, has different ways that someone could approach it, and maybe doesn't even look like political art initially.
Yeah.
And then it was also thinking about how do you make political art for people who don't like political art? I mean, that was kind of the main question when I was in grad school.
Yeah.
I don't know if I actually solved that or not, but that was the major shift.
You know, your family, were they kind of supportive of all? I mean, because originally, you know, I mean, assuming they're raising somebody's like, she's going to be a musician. This is what she wants to do. And then suddenly you make that shift to being a visual artist. How was your family like receptive to that?
Well, I'm the oldest of five kids, so I think they had other kids to worry about. No, but they're no. I mean, my family's great, but I think, yeah, I was just real. It wasn't a consultation so much with that. It was just it was something that I wanted to do. And,
yeah.
You know, yeah, but they're definitely supportive.
Yeah.
Of it. Yeah.
Because I mean, sometimes, you know, I've been interviewed a couple of people, and some of them are like, well, that came out of nowhere. Like, that you wanted to be an artist, you
right.
know?
Yeah. I mean, there's people. I mean, there was always a. My mom is somebody that has an interest in art, and, you know, we'd go to museums when we'd, you know, go visit a city or something. And so it wasn't as if I came from a place that was not supportive of it.
Right.
But I think it probably was a surprise just because for so many years, music had been such a focus.
Yeah. As I mentioned, I looked through all your work, and it's so varied in terms of medium and subject. But one of the common things was there's definitely a historical presence in there. Like it seems that you have this interest in exploring history and kind of reviewing it and seeing it, and somehow it gets applied in your work. And one of the things I forget where you had it in one of your bios online, but I really liked it. But you described your art as mining cultural and political histories, question ideas of boundaries and containment, history, and restaging context and form. So tell me about that.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
I think it is something that I struggled with for a while going back to going to grad school.
Yeah.
So I think that going to grad school, there was the first thing of trying to rethink political art, but it was also the first time that I was addressing things that were personal. So
okay.
It was trying to understand the political through personal things. So the very first pieces that I felt like made a kind of breakthrough for me were looking at security gates and these little drawings of decorative security gates, and thinking about my own relationship to security, and moving from there, that then I felt like I wrote a statement of what my work was that was really kind of specific, where I was really looking at intersections between military and civilian culture. And I felt so good about that statement that I was really limiting myself to only making those kind of pieces. And in particular, I was making these fort pieces at the time. And then anytime anyone was asking me to do a show, it was like, do a fort, do a fort, do a fort. And I felt like I was becoming fort girl. And then I had this really weird show at Patricia Sweetow Gallery. Well, so I was invited to do a show at Patricia Sweetow Gallery. And I was supposed to do a show that was these trees that were planted by the army in the headlands that were made out of military blankets. And that's why she invited me. And then I said, nope, you know what? I'm going to do a show about my rabbit. And we didn't do a show again after that. But I felt like even when I look back at that work, it's a little strange and out there, but it gave me a kind of freedom to then just pursue what I'm actually interested in, instead of feeling confined to making the same kind of work for consistency. And so I think the only thing that I can honestly say that ties the work together is those interests in history.
Yeah.
And then also those, like, really looking at ideas of boundaries. And then whether it's, like, discipline boundaries and looking at, you know, what are those relationships between sculpture and performance, or performance art and street performance, or boundaries that are set up of, like, ideological boundaries. Then from there, I'm kind of allowing myself to just do whatever I want.
Yeah. My background is I studied history as an undergrad.
Oh, wow.
So I found your work compelling. I really loved it. I love the stuff where the earlier stuff you did were too, where you, I saw the forts.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe I'll do another one. I don't know.
And I saw like some of the reenactments. There was like, you know, you had like a, someone dressed up, I forget what period it was, as a soldier.
Civil War reenactor. So, yeah, I did those a couple times. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to kind of lead this into the latest show that you did over at Bass and Rayner, which was, from
the fall.
After the fall. Mm-hmm. And that also, you know, has a little bit of historical references a little bit too as well.
Yeah, so, a lot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so, well, the show came out of a residency that I did at the Neon Museum in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And the Neon Museum is all about, you know, looking at history through that signage.
Yeah.
And so my task there was at the end of the residency, there was going to be this exhibition. And I ended up making these drawings that were thinking about signs as lures, but then also looking at narratives where women have been positioned as lures or temptresses and yeah. that kind of archetype. Mm-hmm. And so started looking at art history and different... sorry, it's loud in my living room right now. I'm totally distracted.
No, Whitney's family is in the other room, just playing records and billiards.
So
playing pool and drinking and
yes,
records. It actually looks really fun.
But we're in here. We're being serious.
Yeah.
But it's Old Master and Post Impressionist paintings were what that series was based on, and that's at Bass and Rayner.
Yeah.
And then those paintings happen to be biblical narratives. Mm-hmm. And so looking at an Adam and Eve painting by Michelangelo, there's Lot's Daughters by Cezanne, which is really like I had not heard that story before doing this project, which I recommend checking that one out.
Yeah.
And then the third one in the show is Jezebel by Celeste.
Mm-hmm.
And then separate from that body of work. And so they're drawings that are proposals to be made into neon.
Okay.
And so they're really kind of... crude approximations of those old master paintings.
Yeah.
And then is that a clear enough explanation?
No, okay. No, it's great. Yeah. Because I think, you know, so their drawings are meant to be proposals, but I mean, they themselves seem to work as art pieces as well. I think what was really awesome for me, like what the aesthetic wise was some parts where if you made a mistake or you wanted to change how you were drawing the image, some cases you just patched it over yeah. with another piece of paper and then painted and drew over it.
Right. And then it's still not a very good approximation over. Like I was looking at it the other day of like this leg on Eve.
Yeah.
The thigh would have to be, it's like two times as long, but it has a patch over it. But, yeah. you know, at a certain point I was like, ah, good enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it works. And I think anybody just walking in not knowing that these are going to be proposals or that these are proposals for neon signs, I mean, I think they're just as compelling. You know?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it took you know, Emily, who one of the co-directors of Bass and Rayner, explained to me, goes, actually, these are proposals. And I was yeah. like, oh, wow. Like,
yeah.
But they're huge. They're like, they're mural-sized
yeah,
drawings.
Yeah. They needed to be life-size.
Yeah.
Or if they got made either life-size or larger than life.
Yeah.
Because they needed to either look like those paintings or they needed to look like the neon characters that you'd see in old Las Vegas.
Yeah.
But then the other piece that's in the show and definitely related to history is looking at Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII's second wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a window piece that's made out of vinyl and it's kind of in like a nail salon sort of style
yeah.
of signage. And it's looking at the Hever Castle portrait, which is one of the more famous portraits of Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
Except there's no portraits of Anne Boleyn that were actually made when she was alive.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved that. Yeah, no one actually knows what she looks like. It's all these projections of, you know, whatever the person
right.
that made that portrait, what they think right. about her.
Yeah.
But then there was this myth that she had six fingers. And so I added a sixth finger to this famous Hever Castle portrait that's on the window.
So let's talk about the Neon Museum for a bit, because it's okay. obviously is what's inspired a lot of what's at Bass and Rayner currently. And I read up a little bit. Well, and I've been to the Neon Museum before.
Oh, okay.
And it's one of those... what you think on the surface seems like a quirky museum, but surprisingly you go in there, it's like, oh, this is actually a well done, like historically. I mean, they try their best, but for the most part, I go walk in, I'm like, okay, I learned a little bit about the history of Las Vegas. I never thought I would learn.
Yeah.
So what? How did you find out about this residency, art residency that they had?
Oh, you know, it's so funny because they asked me that when I was there, and I can't remember where I actually saw it. I mean, I want to say, it might have just been like Twitter or something. I saw like, oh, I applied to this residency, but it was really cool that they were doing, for the first time, a national residency, and they've done local artists for several years, but it really is a gem. I mean, it's something that they do an amazing job preserving Las Vegas history. But the Boneyard is crazy. The Boneyard is what they, you know, call where all the signs are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's organized now, but it was just dumped for a long time. But it's a really kind of remarkable experience to walk through, and then, you know, your sense of scale is really shifts when you're walking through, because these signs were meant to be marquees.
Right.
You're not supposed to be standing right next to them. And then also, I think I really loved, like, you start to see the flaws in the signs, because they're hand-painted, a lot of them, with sign painters. And so you see these things are not perfect, but you'd never notice that if it was,
away.
Yeah. So, yeah. But no, it's a really incredible place. And they have, now I sound like I'm pitching for them, but I love this place. But they have daytime tours, you know, that's really special. But then at night too, some of the signs turn on, and so it's a completely different experience.
Wow. And so then how long were you there for?
I was there for a month.
Wow.
And
have you been to Vegas before then?
I went twice. One time I went for like a quick weekend, and went in November for Thanksgiving, and all the pools are closed, so don't go.
Right.
And then it was kind of depressing. But on Thanksgiving, you know, it was a little lonely. Well,
so as a former, red-blooded American college student who went to Vegas on a weekend trip. Yeah, I know all of these things.
So I should have asked you before. That was the first time that I had been as an adult.
Yeah.
And then I went one time as a kid because I had a cousin that was in a beauty pageant, which was in the 80s. And I stayed at Caesar's Palace, and it was weird.
I would think that would be a little weird. But it sounded like it was a whole family event, though, that you got invited.
Oh, no. A lot of my family was there.
Wow.
Yeah. So those were the two times I had been. But, you know, I hadn't really seen it at all.
Right.
And of course, like, Vegas in the 80s is not what Vegas is today. No. And so to be there for a month, it was really a very different experience. And then they put me up near the old Las Vegas, like the old downtown.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's where all the neon signs are.
Right.
Because, you know, the strip now, it's all LED and crazy video screens, and which is also really amazing.
It's like a Disneyland for adults now. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's something that, I mean, I think for any artist that's interested in fabrication, you can get anything made there. And so it was so incredible to see, like, what kind of options were out there for production.
Yeah.
And, you know, going through, like, talking about Caesar's Palace, like, they'll have, you know, this huge 3-story tall statue, and it's all made out of foam. But you only know that if you touch it. So I was touching a lot of statues there.
what did, other than, of course, obviously, a little bit of influence for the work that you're currently working on right now, what else did you get out of that experience of, like, just being in, I mean, a town like Vegas is not really top of the list as a center for art cultivation at all.
Well, you know, it's funny, though, because they've had different moments. Like, Dave Hickey was there for a little while. He's not there anymore. But UNLV, I think, does some interesting things. But no, I mean, it's not, like, the first place that you think about at all. And there's a lot of art that's actually hidden in the casinos, but it has a hard time competing with everything else. And
right.
So
the gambling, the drinking.
And then just even the installations and the spectacle of everything. Like, you'll see a James Turrell piece, but then you've got, like, other kind of, you know, light installation that's selling you shoes or something across the mall. And that's going to, you know, it's a different kind of competition for your attention.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, there's so much to gain from it, because I think it really is, you know, any interest in spectacle. And then also, you know, it's the strip, and then you go one block behind and it's a whole other place. I mean, I think it was just soaking in a place that isn't like anywhere else, I think. And, you know, so the one body of work was making these proposals for signs that were based on, you know, women as temptress. But then there was another body of work that I made there that was called A Matter of Perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think that was because I was forced to confront all these images that it depended on, like, how you wanted to look at it, whether it was something that was amazing or something that was really horrifying.
Yeah.
And I think that I really felt that push and pull the whole time I was there, and particularly in the downtown area, because I did a lot of work with street performers at one point. And so at first I was looking a lot at the street performers that are there.
Yeah.
And so they have, like, guys that are dressed like babies, and they have a lot of topless showgirls, and they have Tony Montana, and they have, you know, it's a very, you know, special place for people that are doing street performance. But then they also have a lot of vets, and a lot of people just in, like, really desperate situations. And of course, like, the casino industry, like, for somebody that's going, you know, on a weekend, or, you know, that knows how to, like, keep a distance for everything. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's one aspect of it. But then there's a lot of people that, yeah, you see those issues with addiction, and, you know, that's the given there.
Yeah.
But, you know, you see just as many pawn shops as you see, well, not as many, but you see tons of, you know, as many casinos. Like, there's a lot of casinos. But, you know, I think that so a lot of what I got out of it too is just forcing myself to see things from different points of view.
Yeah. I wanted to come back a little bit to after the fall show over at Bass and Rainer. So one of the cool things I wanted to highlight was you had set up, you had made a series of drawings, and you had made, or you had asked or arranged for Bass and Rainer to have a certain percentage of the sales from those drawings go towards the ACLU.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me about what motivated you to want to do that with some of the money from that, from your sales.
Huh. Well, you know, I think, so those drawings were, I mean, I was really looking at them as a suite. So ideally it would be that somebody, if it was going to be for sale at the gallery, they'd have to buy the whole suite, because right. It was a, like, a way of, like, thinking through all the different ideas of the show.
Yeah.
But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to sell them one at a time. And so, you know, we had them there, and I think it was, maybe it was the night of the travel ban or something, or, you know, when the protest erupted,
yeah.
that, I wrote them, and I just asked if we could, do that. 'Cause I think it was just trying to make a little drop in the bucket for mm-hmm. everything. But, you know, the other thing that happened with the show is that initially the opening was scheduled for January 20th.
Right.
So it was something, too, that I just said, like, I really can't have an opening on Inauguration Day. I mean, there yeah. was the J-20 strike.
Right.
And I think there was some debate about whether that was effective or not, or should, you know, maybe we should have art institutions or galleries open to give a counter to it. But I just, there was really no way that anyone was going to be able to think about anything except that.
Yeah.
And so it was just, you know, a really uncomfortable thing that said, no, we have to move.
I know. I mean, it's one of the issues I've had, even wondering what to do with this podcast, because, you know, this is meant to be, you know, to highlight artists and art professionals and, you know, wherever, anywhere in this country, really. And it's hard to do that when your focus wants to be on so much other stuff that's going on in this country. And I think one of the questions I've had was, what do we do? Like, what can we do? Like, what is it, if we really are upset about this and we really are passionate about either fixing something or having something changed, what do we do? And of course, one of the many ways, the most popular way, is marching, protesting. But it was, I love that, you know, yourself and Bass and Rainer came up with this idea of, what about some of the funds from our sales go towards the ACLU, which I think is not the norm. I don't think a lot of galleries do that.
Well, there has been a fair amount of activism that's trying to push things recently. And, you know, I hope one thing is that there's, you know, a momentum now that might fizzle out. But I think that larger question of, like, what do we do? You know, the only thing that I can compare it with is Bush. That was the only time that I was, you know, aware of politics, is, you know, that. I'm sure with Reagan, there were similar feelings with Nixon. But, you know, I think in some ways, like, it doesn't mean either that we have to only make political art that has a very kind of specific efficacy, because
mm-hmm.
I think that might be the role of activism, and that art does operate in this other realm, and I don't want art to go away just because this political situation is so dire.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I personally just feel like I have to figure out every little thing that I can do. And it's not only things like marching or making things that go for donations for political organizations. But I think things like looking for volunteer opportunities or looking for, you know, something that you can do that you feel like you're making a little chip away at what when everything else seems so terrible.
Yeah. Well, what do you think as the art community, especially here in the city like San Francisco, aside from, you know, these examples that we just gave out, what other way you think the art community can do? You think concern, to want to make change, to be involved? Because obviously one of the other big things about all this, aside from, you know, the travel ban and the reversal of a lot of the stuff that, that Obama, President Obama did, President Trump has mentioned the possibility of cutting the NEA.
I haven't been as concerned about that as, you know, education. Yeah. Like, that's something that's, you know, it's irreversible if you have so many years of schools losing more and more funding.
Yeah, or, for you talking specifically to art programming or education in
just
general?
Just education in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, vouchers are really, it's scary that the public schools are already suffering so much and that, you know, if we have more and more money stripped away from it, you know, that's something that I think is that's really at the top of my worries.
Right.
But I think other things like, you know, looking at justice for people of, you know, if there's no accountability for police or, you know, I have family members that are in the military.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if we're having hostile relations with other people. So, I mean, not to say that that's not an issue. Like, of course, I want the NEA to have funding, but I honestly haven't thought as much about, I mean, right. I think we all have a lot of things to worry about.
Right.
But then how do you turn that into something constructive, maybe, is the question, too. Yeah. And I don't know. Do you have answers?
You know, so the thing about me is I've been conflicted because, so my dad, aside from being a former Marine, and he's Hispanic, and the son of immigrants. He's an ICE agent. And my mother came here illegally. So, but they met and they got married, and my mother, you know, got amnesty from Reagan, became an American citizen, so forth, worked hard. And it's kind of weird because I grew up hearing about the different issues that my dad had going to work. And I disagreed with a lot of the things that he said. And then witnessing my parents disagreeing on a lot of things. My mother was very liberal and my dad was pretty conservative. Mm-hmm. Not too conservative, but he, you know, being the former military, he tended to vote Republican a lot. And so for me, I've been just like stuck in the middle. Like, and I mean, I've more than anything, I think this is the first time where I'm kind of just like having to reveal, like, all right, here's the things I disagree with. And I'm finding out I disagree with a lot more things going on right now in terms of this current presidency than I do agreeing. And it's just like the first time I think in my life.
What do you agree with?
I don't agree with anything. That's the first time that it's ever happened to me, because beforehand I've been pretty much in the middle where, you know, I loved Obama. I voted for Obama twice. There were things I disagreed with, like not so much the ideas, but like the implementation of what he did, of some of the stuff he did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I was able to be like, okay, I can see where you guys are coming from on that. But this is the first time where I'm kind of like, I'm trying to see the other side of this and I cannot.
Yeah.
Like, this is just ridiculous.
And
I'm still trying to grasp that. This is the first time I've ever felt that way.
I mean, it's a whole new game in so many different ways. I mean, even the fact that he was elected and so many people thought there's no way. I mean, and a lot of people too thought that was naive, that there was, that, you know, they knew that America was racist and America would vote for a reality star guy.
Yeah.
I guess with this part of what I have not thought this through in any kind of way that I should be saying it into a microphone. But I think for myself, I want to have a separation between, in some ways, of how I'm thinking about art and then how I'm thinking about my political life and actions, because I think they do offer different things. And there's some artists that, I mean, I love a lot of artists that do make work that's, you know, fiercely political. And I also love artists that are making work that just makes me think about the way I experience the world and perception in more abstract ways. And I don't think that you should feel that you have to push one way or the other, or the only way to be making work that's relevant is to make work that's, you know, very specifically hoping for some kind of social change. Mm-hmm. But I think that if we do feel that we want that in our lives, then we do have to absolutely do that in some other kind of way. So I think the thing with Bass and Rainer is, like, the first time that I've ever, or the first time recently at least, that I've kind of tried to put those two together in a small way.
Right.
And knowing that, you know, this is a small donation at the end of the day, but
right. That
it feels like, okay, here's something, and then what's the next something?
Right. It's like you're trying. It's your first try. We're all trying. It's like, what, you know, all you can do is build up on that. Well, and, you know, and you're a teacher. How is it, you know, as a teacher, obviously, I'm assuming there's a lot of students, multiple opinions about what's going on. Has that come into your classrooms, you know, and how have you dealt with that?
Yeah, you know, so I teach at Stanford is my full-time job, and I'm just doing one class now at the Art Institute just to, because it's fun and I like to stay connected. and it's a grad critique seminar. We've only met twice. Oh, I guess, you know, so I was teaching a class there right after the election, and I was kind of surprised. I mean, it came up a little bit, but not too much. And then it was kind of like switching back to figuring out what their work was. But relatively apolitical bunch, I have to say, recently.
Well, maybe it goes back to what you're saying. Maybe it's kind of like, I'm here because I need to take a break from what's going on. And just like, I'm really just focused on learning about art, making art.
Like, I mean, it depends on the kind of work that they're making and how, and also there's a lot of international students that don't feel the same kind of connection, obviously, because they're here for a short period of time and then they're going to go back to their home country. And so I think those conversations have been interesting, but, and also some of those students are a lot more conservative than you might think, but you know, it came up a little bit, but we kind of just went back to the work, which, I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but you know, I'm not a historian. I'm not a political scientist. I can, you know, I'm not a somebody that can talk about this other than just my raw feelings and emotions. And so maybe if we're going to talk about art, I always also just try to talk about it as formally as possible.
Yeah.
Where I want everybody's content to be their own. So I don't necessarily want to debate the ideas that somebody is presenting because that's theirs. But how can we talk about how they're presenting it and do their intentions line up with how we're perceiving it?
Yeah.
And so that's impossible to be totally objective, but it's like the desire, because I do, I mean, we all have our like opinions and biases and taste. And so I think that more than anything, I've just been struggling with how do I make sure that I keep things as objective as possible? So maybe I've been purposely shying away from conversations that are very specifically political for better or worse.
That makes sense to me. I mean, I think you want the focus in those classrooms to be much about them and their work and you helping them with their work.
And you know, so like last, when do I teach that class? On last Monday, there was a grad student that, you know, is doing work that's looking at oil in Oklahoma and how that's tied to education. And I guess there was a proclamation put out by the Oklahoma, somebody in the government there, it wasn't the governor, but it was about like praying for more oil. And it was really kind of an crazy thing that there was no separation of church and state at all. Like it was this whole proclamation about how God gave us oil and we need oil. And so, you know, that part of that work is that she's trying to start a dialogue. And so the room then is talking about those issues, but it's not a debate of those issues. It's something that then comes back to, okay, how is the work communicating this? And then what's the best context for this? And again, those kind of questions of what are you really trying to do, and is activism a better bet for some of the things, or does it need writing to go along with it? How does this work when it's translated to a commercial gallery? So, I mean, I think all those things are really kind of complicated and messy.
Yeah. So you teach and you make art right now. You kind of see yourself continuing to do both in the future, or do you have a preference of like, in the long run, I want to actually just be able to make art full time?
Well, no, I mean, I think they feed each other. Okay. And so I think that I've been really lucky for the last 3 years. I've had this job at Stanford where it's a great gig. I only actually teach 2 classes a week. There's some administrative things because I lead this program, but it's given me a lot of time to make work. And then I'll teach a class, you know, one grad class at the Art Institute, and then it's fun. Like, I'm coming in, there's no pressures, there's no meetings. Like, it's just, you know, hey, what are you working on? All right, great, see you later. And that's amazing because then, yeah, you're thinking, like, just like this conversation, I'm sure I'll have. Have you ever heard this saying, the wit of the staircase? It's like a French saying. I'm sure it sounds a lot better in French. But it's like, when you walk down the stairs, you think about all the things that you wish you would have said, and then you didn't actually say in the moment. So yeah. I'm sure I'm going to have that. But it's also that good thing of, like, you know, you're like, this is like forcing, you know, a confrontation of like these various ideas about relationship between art and politics. And same thing in the class, that the work that gets brought up, like all sorts of different issues come up, and it makes you, you know, go back and reconsider, like, what is your opinion? Like, what is your stance? And then you also end up doing a lot of research for other people's projects that then sometimes, like, something comes from that, particularly when I'm teaching, like, art history classes. Like, it always influences my work a lot. Like, I did the shock class, and then it was like, oh, yeah, things got, like, weird for a little while. But, yeah, so I, you know, of course, and then it would be amazing to just be an artist and have that be, you know, have that kind of intensive focus, but, you know, it's a pretty good job.
And so tell me about this program that you lead over at Sanford.
Yeah, so it's called Honors in the Arts. My contract ends in June. so it was a three-year gig, but it's an interdisciplinary program. So it's students from all across the university. They propose a project that is has to be engaging, with at least two different disciplines, and it's arts with an S. So it's I have students working in theater, in music, actually just a little bit in visual arts, a lot of creative writing. Like, I had a student that was a human biology major, and she was doing these spoken word performances looking at marginalized communities and childbirth narratives. And she's actually in medical school right now, and so it was something that was a way for her to think through things that she was experiencing in a clinical setting, but it was also really good art. Like, she was really amazing. Grishma Shaker. And then I also had a student that was coming from a product design, and then he was interested in queer theory, and he had this proposal to make drag furniture, which I don't think we ever actually figured out what that meant exactly, but that was also a really fun project. And then I had a student from the math department that was a jazz drummer, and he was looking at the idea of the shape of sound and wanted to chart that, and made these videos that were looking at what does it mean when someone's talking about the shape of sound, and then was doing mathematical analysis to make these visual diagrams of it. So it's been really amazing. And also, it's things that I don't do, and so I'm also learning a lot. So that's like one of those examples of, you know, students that are writing plays. Like, so I end up reading a lot more plays just so I can stay up to speed.
And this program was your idea, or is this already existing?
No, it existed, and then been there working and tweaking some things. But we only accept up to 14 students a year, and then I work with them all year, and then they also have two mentors for whatever their project is. So, it's been amazing.
So
it's been really
fun. Do these students go on to do eventually?
Well, like, one's the one I mentioned is at medical school. Actually, two are in medical school. One person, last year, Brittany Newell, her book got published, so she's a writer now.
Oh, wow.
There was one person doing films, and I think he's gone on now working on film crews.
Brittany Newell sounds familiar. What book is
this? Ula is the book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, comes out, I think, or maybe it's out now. Yeah, I think it's out now, but that was incredible. She got the book deal, like, while she was in the program.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, so then at that point, you know, we're reading it, and it's like, well, maybe just talk to your editor. But, yeah, really good time there.
Wow.
And they also have so many great, strange archives and libraries there.
Yeah.
Like, there's the Stanford Player Piano Project. Have you heard about that?
No.
So it's the largest collection of player pianos in the world. And it's awesome. And it also, all these kind of early devices to make sound. But so this one player piano, they were able to figure out how to not only have it play the keys, but then also indicate, you know, the difference in the dynamics.
Yeah.
And so they'd have people play the roles. Like, there's one role that's Gershwin. And so you can hear, it's like having a ghost in the room, because you hear when he made a mistake, but you also hear how loud he was playing, and it's you know, then there's also sparks that are coming from this old like wood piano, and there's a librarian that's freaking out because they don't want to have a fire, you know, in the library. So that like, yeah, those little like hidden nuggets are actually really cool over there.
So tell me what else is going on art-wise for you. What other, because I know other than Bastion Rainer, you have a couple things happening as well currently, right?
Yeah. So, well, I've got a project that's over at the Arts Commission Gallery that's in the Veterans Building across from City Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a project that I was asked to be part of a show that's looking at connections between individuals and veterans. And then they asked me to do something that was site-specific. And so when I was going through the building, there's actually these series of stained glass windows on when you go up on either side of the building. And looking at those windows, you know, stained glass is beautiful, of course.
Right.
But then when you're actually looking at what's being depicted, it's really a glorification of these various wars. And it felt like there was information that was missing. And one of the other tasks that they gave me was to talk with different veterans groups in the building. And then talking with all these different veterans groups, I started to feel like it was impossible. Like, what can I possibly make that's going to represent accurately Vietnam veterans' experience, somebody that recently came from Afghanistan, and someone that was in World War II? Like, there's so many different ways that they ended up in the military and ways that they feel about things and experiences. I really wanted to do something that was stained glass, yeah, or that would go with these stained glass windows. And so it's a proposal for a new window to be installed. And it's using the language of like Dutch and Flemish still life painting, particularly like floral still life.
Oh, yeah.
But it was, you know, when you look at those paintings, like it was a lot of it is about conquest, yeah, because, you know, none of those flowers could actually be blooming at the same time of year. And it was also, you know, looking at all the different travel that was happening and what could be imported and brought back. And so there were these, you know, fantasies constructed. And so it was, so it's this really overflowing bouquet that uses that kind of symbolic representation. Some of it is related to military things, like there's red poppies, and that's the American Legion flower. There's dandelions, which military brats have adopted. Yeah. But then it's also the flowers of nations that have been sites of military operations. And the thing that's kind of shocking is it's not even all of the places that have had military operations, because some of those places don't have official flowers.
Oh, wow.
That was something that was really remarkable, to see how many places have been impacted. And I wanted to do something that, of course, was acknowledging the veterans that are in that building, but also looking at the civilians that are affected by U.S. conflict.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And so I'm hoping it's a piece that is, again, that thing of like, it's open enough that there's a conversation can happen, and it's right, not feels like an attack.
Right.
But there is a critical stance too, right, of
it's not like against for either side, but it's kind of opening it up to like, this is something to think about and something to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was, you know, it's a memorial building, but I think like the memorial really just needs to be for all the people that have had traumas because of,
because there's, it's not just military veterans, but there's always civilians too that. Before we wrap it up, I guess one more chance of to plug the show over at Bastion Rainer. So when is it open till?
Till February 25th.
And it's at the Minnesota Street Project.
Yes.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure. But yeah, you said you don't like spicy food, but there's Hunan food now.
It's okay. I can deal with the spicy food. Right. Well, thank you for coming
on. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, that's it for this week. I want to thank Whitney for having me over at her place to do the podcast. It was a pleasure meeting and getting to know her. Be sure to check out her show After the Fall at Bastion Rainer, which ends February 25th. For more information about her work, be sure to visit her website at WhitneyLynnStudio.com. You can also follow her on Twitter and Instagram at WhitneyLynnStudio. And lastly, be sure to follow the Art Scene Podcast on Instagram and Twitter as well at ArtScenePC. For past episodes and photos of my guests and their work, visit artscenepc.com. All right, till next time. We'll be right back.